when we... You should try to take a quick run through it. Okay, we're going through review of Lesson 18. We talked about the future, middle, and passive forms last time, and those are kind of simple to deal with because your future middle is just using, and the future passive both use those passive endings, and it's just a base difference. The future passive is based on the third, on the sixth principal part. So we talked about that. Deponent verbs, that next section, basically is just dealing with the concept that certain verbs will not have active forms, but use, they'll use either middle or passive forms for active meaning. And the patterns for those are usually odd. Sometimes all the forms will be deponent, other verbs will have part of them deponent, part of them not. And so you see a chart there at the top of page 107 of the most common ones. The two most important ones are ginomai and erkomai. Those are the ones that are the most common that are deponent verbs. And with ginomai, you see that you have passive form there, the omai ending, but the meaning is more of an active meaning, although this is an equated verb, so it's hard to say active or passive. Genesomai also is deponent. Egenomain and egenethane, this particular one for the aorist has two possible forms, one of them a middle form, the other one a passive form, but both of them have active meaning. And then with erkomai, you have erkomai is deponent, elusomai is deponent, but aelthone is an ordinary active form and it doesn't have a deponency in the aorist. And at the top of page 107 there you see a chart of some of the most common ones, poriumai, decomai, lambano, mantano. See, lambano and mantano are okay in the present, but in the future they go deponent. Okay, there's nothing too much to say about that. It's just that the meanings, it is only having to do with the fact that certain sets of forms apparently don't exist, and passive forms are used for active meaning. And there, it may go beyond that into the kinds of verbs that are deponent, usually are verbs that don't have a real strong active type of meaning anyway, and it may have something to do with the meaning of the verb. But all we can do with it is just be aware of the existence of these things, and as you get using them, especially with erkomai and ginomai, you'll get so used to those forms after a while that you probably won't even think of the fact that they're deponent. Okay, the verb eimi, the paradigm is given there, a little bit unusual. The verb to be is irregular in most of any language that I've been familiar with. And we also find that the forms are rather limited. There's no aorist forms. Obviously, there's no passive forms since the thing is an equative verb. And so you have a relatively simple paradigm, just present, imperfect, and future. The imperfect covers the past tenses. And I suppose there's some reason to the imperfect. You recall has got a progressive aspect to it. And usually existence is rather progressive. It's not punctiliar, you know. If something exists, or predication of existence or something of that nature, it's usually got a certain type of progressive aspect to it, so perhaps that's the logic behind it. But nevertheless, that's the paradigm. So that's all there was in that chapter. Now, the next chapter, 19, I'm not even going to bother to look at. Remember, we didn't take too much time with it as it was. It was just a matter of analyzing the first and second declensions that we've had already into basic morphemes and breaking it down and so forth. And like I said, that may be instructive for some purposes, but it may labor you. By the time you look at that chart on page 112 there, I think it's just easier to memorize the paradigms than to go through that. But the reason that chapter was given was to prepare for third declension, and in third declension we see more justification for that kind of an analysis because of the differences in stems and the kinds of situations you run into that may you know, help facilitate learning the third declension. So let's take a look at lesson 20 here, and this is our first chapter on third declension. I'm not going to go through this real slowly. It's mainly a matter of just reviewing paradigms on this, but I will go through it enough to just delineate our different types and what basically is happening to each one, just for review purposes. We have an introduction here that kind of breaks down the whole topic, and you'll see here in this section 146 that we have in the third declension, the critical factor is how does the stem end on the word. because especially because some of the endings we stick on it, on the third declension, start with sigma. The nominative masculine singular, masculine or feminine singular, actually, and the dative plural forms are going to begin with a sigma, and that's where your problem is going to be primarily. So we find two major categories, the major consonant stems and the minor consonant stems, of these first consonant stems. And then there's another category for the upsilon stems, and then another category for iota stems, epsilon, upsilon stems, and sigma stems. So we have quite a different number of different possibilities here. Major consonant stems are these, include the labials, P, beta, or phi, the velars, kappa, gamma, or chi, and the dentals, tau, delta, or theta. This is the same basic kind of categorizations we saw with our phonological changes before the endings for the aorist and for the future. So it's a similar kind of situation. Since we're adding sigma to these, this is why these categorizations are made. And the same kind of thing basically happens, that we'll get a sigma added to a P, for example, that'll become C. And so same situation there. Then the minor consonant stems, which include first the nasals, nu or nu tau, and the liquid stems, lambda or rho. Then the upsilon stems, section B here, the bases end in upsilon and have no stem formative. So, and those aren't too bad, because now all you have to do is add a sigma or whatever. As long as you've got a vowel sound there, there's no real problem in adding endings, although we do see with the adjectives in that category a few unusual things. Then the last category is nouns whose bases end either in a consonant or a vowel and which have as stem formatives, and these ones have stem formatives now. In other words, another little morpheme stuck in there. First, in iota alternating with epsilon, these are called iota stems. And epsilon-upsilon alternating with epsilon, that's called the epsilon-upsilon stems. And then either an omicron eta or epsilon, the so-called sigma stems. That's the worst of all. That's the one that's often called the fourth declension. Okay, looking on the next page, you'll see the paradigm for the endings themselves in third declension. Just a sigma for, and the masculines and feminines are the same, and the neuters are slightly different. So we just have those two categorizations. We don't have a separate categorization for masculine and feminine in third declension. They come up the same. So masculine and feminines will be in the nominative sigma, the genitive omicron sigma, the dative iota, the alpha, I mean the accusative alpha, the plural nominative epsilon sigma, genitive plural as always omega nu, and the dative would be sigma iota with optional nu, and the accusative alpha sigma. And notice that it's the nominative singular, which ends simply in sigma, and the dative plural, which starts with a sigma, sigma iota nu, that are going to be our problem areas. In the neuters, we get a zero for the nominative and accusative singulars, so no ending at all. In the plural, we get alphas for the nominative and accusative. Other than that, the paradigm is the same as it is for the feminines and the masculines. Okay, then remark one deals with those phonological changes. P, beta, or phi plus sigma becomes C, etc. Those I think you're all familiar with. Remark two is dealing with a certain class of neuter nouns. The only neuter nouns in this subclass have bases ending in tau. In the nominative and accusative singular, that is before the case number suffix zero, this tau is changed to sigma. So in the nominative accusative, instead of, for example, with the word false, instead of just having fault for the nominative forms, singular forms, and accusative in the neuter, it changes to false. And then the stem goes back to fault when you add the suffixes. So that's kind of an unusual feature in that. Now, there's an exception to that also, and there's a certain class of nouns that end in mat, mu alpha tau. There's quite a large class of these. And instead of turning the tau into a sigma on these, they just drop the tau off. So pneuma, for example, it's the nominative form is pneuma, but the genitive is pneumatos, and you get the tau there back. Think of the tau as part of the stem, but the tau drops off in the nominative and accusative neuter forms, neuter singulars. Okay. Then remark three here, the dictionary form of a noun of the third declension is the nominative singular, as in the first two declensions. It is especially important in the case of third declension nouns to learn the genitive singular also, and this is cited in good dictionaries along with the article. And of course, what is the reason for the necessity of learning the genitive singular on third declensions especially? It goes on to say here, but remember? Huh? Yes. In order to be able to unambiguously determine the stem, one needs to know the genitive form. because of the fact, especially with these major consonant stems, because of the fact that several different letters plus sigma will result in a particular letter. For example, if it's a C, that can be the result of a P sigma, a beta sigma, or a phi sigma. And just looking at the fact that the C is there does not give you enough information to tell which of the stem elements, which letter was the last letter in the stem. So if you saw something, for example, like whole arops in the nominative, you wouldn't know necessarily whether the genitive form was arabos, arapos, or arafos. But the genitive form will be given to you, therefore you can determine what the stem is, and then with that information you can figure out the rest. So it's especially important with these third declensions to have that genitive form. Okay, another remark for, note the neuter nouns differ from masculine and feminine nouns only in the nominative, accusative, singular, plural. Okay, that's not too surprising. The same thing happened in the first and second declension types as far as the second declension differing, neuters differing from the masculines. Okay, then the rest of the chapter is just giving some paradigms for various ones and examples of them. And we have ho arabs here, two arabos, to arabi, ton araba, hoi arabes, ton arabon, tois arabsi. There again you get the phonological change, and trus arabas. That is all pretty straightforward, I think, as far as these first paradigms are concerned. Then section 150 gives a few feminine nouns, and they have a few irregularities. Gunei, for example, has a different stem. Gunaikos, you have a different stem vowel there for the rest of the paradigm. Dental stems here, section 151, and there you can take note especially of the last example there, tophos, with that unusual thing about the stem, and then tosoma, same thing, with the that remark two back there was talking about soma, it's tosoma but two somatos. The tau drops off in the nominative form here on this neuter and in the accusative. Okay, and then a few more irregular nouns are mentioned, section 152. Opus, for example, where again you omicron upsilon sigma in the nominative form, but the rest of it is pretty straightforward. Okay, any questions on anything in this chapter? This was the easiest of the chapters. And it's just a matter of reviewing it, and just if you've got the basic ending paradigm memorized for third declension, that's about all you're going to need for recognition primarily, and then just being generally familiar with the kinds of things you can expect to happen. Okay, so chapter 21 is the minor consonant stems, and that consists of your nasals and liquids, the nasals ending in nu or nu tau, and the liquids ending in lambda or rho. And the basic thing here is that neither one of those sets will take a sigma at all. You can't put a sigma onto it. They don't like that kind of a sound. So instead of getting a sigma, something else is going to happen. And generally what's going to happen is that the vowel preceding the final consonant will be lengthened if it's short. That will be what represents the sigma. And then there's a chart, kind of a description here as to what will take place depending on the noun. If the noun stems ends in epsilon nu or eta nu, or they'll have eta nu in the nominative singular. So there'll be no sigma, but there'll be a lengthening of the epsilon to an eta. And if it's already an eta, then there won't be any change. Nouns that have stems in omicron nu or omega nu will have omega nu. So the omicron nu will lengthen. Nouns with stems in omicron nu tau will lose the tau so that they too have nominative singulars in omega nu. So the new tau types will be similar, at least in the nominative forms there. They'll lose the tau and get a lengthening if possible. Nouns with stems in epsilon rho or eta rho have eta rho in the nominative singular. Nouns with stems in omicron rho and omega rho will have omega rho in the nominative singular. Same kind of thing happening with those. Then the dative plural of nasal stems but not of liquid stems, the suffix combines with the stem as follows. Nouns with stems in epsilon nu have dative plurals in epsilon sigma iota. So the nu just drops off and you get the sigma. Nouns with stems in eta nu have AC eta sigma iota, omicron nu has omicron sigma iota, and omega nu has omega sigma iota, and omicron nu tau has omicron upsilon sigma iota. So the omicron nu tau are the ones that are especially strange, that you get the usi ending on those. But basically what's happening is the nu is dropping off, or the nu tau in that last case, and a lengthening of the vowel, or in some cases no change in the vowel at all, for example the epsilon nu, the epsilon sigma iota. So that's something to watch there as well. Okay, the paradigms, nasal stems, few examples. Hopoi, Maine for shepherd is a good example. It's Hopoi, Maine. You get an eight anew in the nominative. And the stem was two poimenos. The stem was an epsilon. Now, you couldn't tell that, of course, unless you looked at the genitive form or in the dictionary if you had it, because it could be eta or epsilon and still end up whole poimane in the nominative. So, again, you need to take a look at the genitive to find exactly what the stem is going to do. But once you've got that nominative genitive form, then everything else follows suit. Pay special attention to the dative plural there, tois poimesi. There is no nu there. It's not poimensi. They do keep the sigma here, but in this case, the nu drops off. They avoid the combination nu sigma, one way or the other, either by eliminating the sigma or eliminating the nu. Okay, then the rest of these examples are similar to that. Helene, there is another example, but there's an example where it was eta. The stem was eta all the way through. Okay, then there's a few irregular ones here mentioned. Ho-kyo-on-en-ho-odus for tooth. That's an omicron new tau stem, but it gets omicron upsilon in the nominative also. Liquid stems, ho-air for air. We'll get probably the English word from the Greek there. Soter. There's a number of these agency type nouns where it's somebody who is or does something. Pater, mater, and thugater, those are all irregular, and they're all irregular in a similar fashion. And the irregularity has to do with the epsilon, whether it appears or doesn't appear. Sometimes the epsilon drops out completely, and that was something you just had to learn again. But the pattern was the same for pater, mater, and thugater, so that was a little helpful at least. Okay, then the nasal stems here. One example, nasal stem adjectives, excuse me. The adjectives of this type have two sets of forms. I'm looking at section 158 here. One set serves for both masculine and feminine. The other serves for neuter. So we have, instead of having three separate paradigms like we did for the first and second declension adjectives, all we need to know is the two paradigms, one for the masculine and the feminines and one for the neuters. And they pretty much follow the basic patterns described in the lesson for nouns. So the masculine and feminine forms are like those of nasal stem nouns described in this lesson. The neuter forms are similar but have case number suffixes for neuter nouns of the third declension. So it's just basically what you've already seen in this chapter. Arsene and arsen is a good example up there in the next paradigm. And here we only need to list two forms because the masculines and the feminines are going to use the same form. And you notice the difference here. For the masculine and feminine, you have arsane with an eta because the sigma being added lengthened that epsilon to an eta. Whereas in the neuter, where you're only added zero, it still it stays arsen, and you get the epsilon there. So there's the difference. And then the genitive forms are the same. The dative forms are the same. The accusative forms are different again, arsena versus arsen. Okay, so that's a third declension adjective. At least a third declension nasal stem adjective. Now we'll find that other adjectives may not be quite so nice to deal with in the third declension as we'll see in the next chapter and so forth. Then there's a little discussion of comparatives, adjectives of comparison in section 159, and the fact that in the Greek the comparatives are used much like their English equivalents. Than is expressed in Greek either by the genitive case or by the particle a, which has a smooth breathing, followed by the same case that the noun of the noun being compared. So we looked at some of these examples, and there's two ways to do it, either with the genitive or to do it with the particle a. And John 5:20, just looking at one example, mesona touton dexe auto erga, he will show him works greater than these. So mesona is the adjective greater, and then the comparison is being given now by a genitive, two-tone, of these, greater of these, literally, greater from these. That's very much like a Hebrew idiom for comparison. Now, they'll use a preposition of or from and use a similar kind of construction to this. They don't have a genitive case like Greek does, but they do a similar kind of thing. And then using the particle a, you see example down in John 4:1, ho Jesus pleonis mathetas baptize a Ioannes. Jesus is baptizing more disciples than John. And there, when you use the particle A, you're not going to use a genitive form like for John. It's going to be the same as Jesus. It'll be it'll be nominative or whatever the comparative noun was. So that's pretty straightforward. Those won't be any problem when you see them in the text. Those are pretty easy to identify, yes.
Well, the main sign,
it's almost got a substantive sense to it. It will show him greater works greater than these. Actually, it goes down. It actually goes down to erga, the very last word in the sentence, mesona erga, and it's almost understood. You've got quite a split there, but you kind of have to put them together in your mind. Or the idea is, he will show him greater works than these works. So you kind of repeat it maybe in English, but the Greek is doing something similar here than English does by not repeating the word erga, mesona erga touton dexe auto. Or you could word it repeating the erga twice, I suppose, but they just don't do it. But the mesona does actually modify erga here. It's referring to greater works. So the literal idea is, he will show him works greater than these works. So, and I suppose you might expect to see an erga, mesona erga touton dexe auto erga, greater works than these. He will show him works greater than these works, or something like that. We would translate in English that way. Okay. Any other questions on those points, other than just reviewing the memorization of the paradigms and what takes place? Okay, third declension, third chapter on that, chapter 22, the vowel stems and the sigma stems, those were the hardest for sure. And the biggest problem was, see, you might think a vowel stem would be easier because all you got is a vowel now, and you just add your endings on, you don't have those phonological changes. It would be easier except for the fact that the vowel stem itself isn't consistent, and through the paradigm, sometimes it's the otis, sometimes it's epsilon, etc. And that's where the problem comes on that. As far as the endings themselves are concerned, it's not too much of a problem, although there are a few exceptions to the ending systems, too. And so these little complications just kind of throw a little bit of a monkey wrench in the works. They don't really pose much of a problem as far as identification of forms is concerned, however, which is the most common task you'll be performing when you're doing translating, is identifying the form. And you'll generally be able to tell that it's third declension. You'll be able to tell what the case number is, and so we're just by looking at it, having been exposed to the various possibilities that exist, although you may not be able to predict what the possibility was if you're just given the word. And of course, since we're normally working from Greek to English, this doesn't pose too much of a problem. So the upsilon stems, first of all, they're pretty easy to deal with, except for the fact that in the accusative singular masculine form, the suffix instead of alpha turns to a nu. So for iskus, for example, for fish, it's pretty straightforward, just adding the endings on. Since you've got a upsilon there, you can add a sigma onto that just fine. So you can have ho iskus, tu iskulos, to iskui, but ton iskun. Instead of iskua, like you might have expected, it's iskun. So take note of that. And then the noun for strength and so forth is the same. But basically, there's no problem except for that change in the ending. Now, the next section deals with adjectives in this category. And you might expect them to be just the same, but they're not quite. If you take note here, section 161, the declension of upsilon stem adjectives differs in important respects from the declension of upsilon stem nouns just described. Indeed, in the upsilon stem adjectives, the upsilon may be regarded as a stem formative rather than as a part of the base. This upsilon appears only in the masculine and neuter, nominative and accusative singular. Elsewhere, the stem formative is epsilon. So here we're introduced to this variable stem formative, sometimes upsilon, sometimes epsilon, and that same kind of pattern is going to occur with these other vowel stems later on. The case number suffixes are similar to those for upsilon stem nouns, but with further exceptions. The genitive singular suffix is omega sigma rather than omicron sigma, and the nominative accusative plural masculine suffixes are both iota sigma rather than epsilon sigma and alpha sigma. The feminine forms of the adjectives of this form class conform to the first declension. So now we get a third declension for masculines, third declension for neuter, but first declension for feminines. So this class is kind of a hybrid between the older types of adjectives we learned about and those nasal stem third declensions that we learned about earlier. So we have for masculines, we have upsilon stem, but the upsilon turns to an epsilon in all but the nominative and accusative singular forms. So it's iskus, but then it's it's oxus, but then oxeos for the word for sharp. And notice it's omega sigma rather than omicron sigma in the genitive form. And then you've got your oxun there for the accusative. Remember that nu there instead of the alpha. Then for the plurals, you have oxes for both of those forms, nominative and accusative, where, as before, you would have expected epsilon sigma for the first one. And, of course, you would get certain contractions as a result of that. And alpha sigma for the last one. So you're getting into some situations where, in part because of the fact that there's contractions taking place and certain vowel combinations that they don't like, we're running into differences in the paradigm as a result of that. Okay. The feminine forms go to the alpha type first declension endings. And alpha type, of course, because of the stem and the stem ending in a vowel. Notice your stem vowel all the way through there is epsilon iota. So you just add epsilon iota and then add the first declension alpha type endings for the feminine forms. Okay, then section 162 goes on to talk about the iota stem nouns and epsilon upsilon stem nouns. And the remarks, first of all, iota stem nouns are similar to the upsilon stem adjectives in the masculine. That is, the stem formative iota appears in the nominative, accusative, and singular, but is replaced by epsilon in the other forms. The case number suffixes are as described in section 161. So these case number suffixes are just like the ones up here on these crazy adjectives. Now we're talking about iota stem nouns. And then the epsilon upsilon stem nouns differ from the iota stem nouns in that, one, the stem formative is epsilon upsilon, the nominative singular, and elsewhere eta. And then the case number suffix in the accusative is alpha rather than nu. It goes back to the alpha again for the epsilon upsilon stems. These are the kind of things that make this real hard to remember. You know, all these little things where it reverts back or there's been a change and so forth. But you've got a couple of examples here. These iota stem nouns are quite frequent. And they're almost all feminine. I think there's only one opus, the only one that's not feminine in the New Testament. And the epsilon upsilon stem nouns are all masculine, and they're also quite common. So you'll see these enough to, you know, be familiar with them. And I think a lot of the exceptions will not be as difficult to recognize just because you see these things quite frequently. So whole opus there, our first example, whole opus, two opheos, again that omega sigma, to ofe, ton ofin, the new there. But if you look down at whole basileus, it's whole basileus, to basileos, to basile, and ton basilea, there you get the alpha back. Okay. And just a list of some of the most common nouns in these categories. Then we come to those infamous sigma stems. And they call them sigma stems apparently because some old sigma stem forms in an earlier period of the language apparently existed, and then the sigma was lost. But they're still categorizing them as sigma stems because they fit certain things in common with them. Excuse me. Here, the best thing I think to do, he goes into a discussion of stem formatives, either omicron, epsilon, or eta, and so forth, the kinds of suffixes, etc. But I think the simplest thing to do is just to memorize the paradigm. Case number suffixes are as follows, and put them on a real noun and see what you come up with. It's about the only reasonable way, I think, to memorize these. Fortunately, there's not a whole lot of them in the language, but there's enough to slow us down. So you see a couple of examples on the next page. Masculine nouns, sun genes, for example. And that's the kind of noun that's easy to confuse with a first declension masculine, like mathetes. And, of course, the way that you would know it's not in that category is, to know the genitive form. If you see the genitive form omicron upsilon sigma, then you know that you're dealing with sigma stem third declension. But it's eta sigma, omicron upsilon sigma, epsilon iota, eta, just plain eta for the accusative form. And some of those are perhaps, admittedly, some of the hardest ones to recognize because you don't see them very often. And if you see something like ton sun gene, and you see something ending in an eta, but it had ton on the front of it, you know, what is that? And whenever you find yourself saying, what is that, consider immediately sigma stem third declension nouns, because that's probably what it's going to end up being. Okay, then neuter nouns are slightly different as far as the ending systems. To, eth, nos, you get omicron sigma in the, both the accusative and nominative singular forms, and then eta in the plural nominative accusative forms, and then the rest of the paradigm is similar to what we saw above. And then under the adjectives, basically the same as the noun in the masculine. In the neuter, slight difference there. You get an epsilon instead of omicron. It's alethes instead of alethos, like it was up there with ethnos. So you there. Other than that, they're basically the same. Yes?
Did we say that the feminine nouns would be formed the same way as the masculine, or were there no
feminines? Apparently there's no feminines in the category. I don't know if he makes a statement to that effect or not. He does list masculine and feminine over here as being the same, so they would be the same. The only examples he gives are of masculine and neuters. The adjectives, of course, would be masculine and feminine, but... I don't see a statement here that would nail this down. The most important ones that he lists as far as the nouns are concerned are all neuters. So we may not have any feminines in that category. If we do, they're probably very rare. But if they do exist, they would follow the pattern for the masculine. Okay. Any other questions? I know that's kind of a rush through it, but... there's probably nothing more that can be done except just sitting down and laboring with the memorization again. Okay. But third declension is the nastiest of all the declensions, and you can see why there. The next chapter is a review of verb inflections. Again, we won't belabor that point. This is, again, the same kind of analysis with verbs, the verbs that have been learned up to this point, breaking down the analysis into various morphemes, and breaking down the suffixes into just the raw suffix without the other morphemes attached. And that kind of analysis, as I said, has its place, but then again, you need to be careful that you don't get so wrapped up in that you lose sight of what you're doing. And it also serves to kind of set the stage. Now, you see a more or less complete set of paradigms here in section 171, which is kind of valuable. So that's nice to have. But it's leading up to a discussion of contract verbs and understanding what happens with contract verbs. And the basic situation with contract verbs is that the stem ends in a vowel. And when the stem ends in a vowel, many of the suffixes for verbs that you're adding onto start with vowels. And so your problem is that you have two vowels being put together, and many times these vowels will not retain the separate syllables, but they'll contract, and they'll contract according to certain predictable rules. Fortunately, this is a rather predictable type of phenomena. So you see a chart here, which may be looked at to, if you just memorize this chart, you'll be able to figure out what all these contract verbs do. But the contract verbs will end in one of three vowels, either an alpha, the a-o verbs, or an epsilon, the e-o verbs, or an omicron, the o-o verbs. And so it'll be one of those three categories, and your suffixes will begin with one of these suffixes across the top, or one of these vowels, either an epsilon, the iota, an eta, eta with the iota subscript, omicron, omicron, epsilon, or omega. And this chart will give you what the resultant contraction will be. If you've got an a-o verb, for example, and this suffix begins with an epsilon, it's just going to simply be an alpha. If it's an epsilon iota, it'll be alpha with the iota subscript, etc. So knowing that, the paradigms are pretty predictable. And of course, when you run into one of the forms that the future forms, for example, where you add a sigma to the stem, some of these other forms, before you add the endings, there's going to be no problem at all. There's nothing irregular about the contract verbs there. It's only where you're adding an ending system onto the basic vowel sound that you're running into any problem. So here's the paradigms that show the problems. Section 174 for agapao, your present active form is going to be a place where that happens. And notice that in the paradigm they're showing you the uncontracted form, then the contracted form in boldface type. And as I mentioned, the dictionary forms will often be rather artificial. For example, if you're looking up agapao, in most of the dictionaries you'll look it up under agapao, even though that form doesn't really exist in the language, in use in the language. See, the first person form would be agapo because of contraction. But agapao is listed because that will identify that verb not only as to its ending and so forth, but it will identify as to what category it's in to help you predict what these contractions will be. So that's the way they list them. So agapao contracts to agapo. Agapa ace would contract to agapas. Agapa A would attract to contract to agapa, etc. Pretty straightforward. This isn't really as difficult a chapter as many of the others, of course. And here, poieo is a good example of an eo verb, and pleroo an example of an oo verb, and there you see the contractions that exist. Okay. Then a few notes in section 177 about the contract verbs. Apart from tenses formed on the present base, that is, the indicative, in the indicative, only the present and imperfect, active and middle, active middle passive, the forms of almost all contract verbs are perfectly regular. And a few comments along those lines. The final alpha of the ao verbs is changed to ada before a non-zero tense formant, unless this alpha is immediately preceded by a vowel or a rho. So if you put a non-zero tense formant on it, like a sigma or something like that, the base will change, and the alpha will change to an ada. So you have to kind of learn that feature, but once you do, then everything's pretty regular. So the future is agapeso, and it's not agapaso, it's not just adding the sigma on, the alpha changed to an ada before that non-zero tense formant. But then after that, the endings are just straightforward, and there's no contraction that takes place. Aristactive, agapesa, and agapesa, aorist passive, agapesain, same thing, ada before the non-zero tense formant, whether it be a theta or a sigma. For the eo verbs, we have the future, aso, and the aorist active, aasa, irregular augment on this one. So there's a few notes on that. Then the final epsilon eo verbs is changed to ada before non-zero tense formant. So for poio, we have poieso in the future, the epsilon lengthens to ada. So the same thing basically happens for these as happens for the alpha. There are a few verbs that retain the epsilon. These must be learned. Kaleo has future kaleso, aorist active at kalesa, etc. So then the irregular aorist passive goes back to the eklethane. You get an ada there. Then the final omicron of the oo verbs is changed to omega. So basically the idea, philosophy is a lengthening before the non-zero tense formant, and there will be some exceptions to that, as you've seen. Okay, questions on contract verbs. Those, are not difficult to recognize. When you see a form, it pretty well has to be a contract verb form. You might sometimes get confused with a me verb in some of the forms, because they start to look a little bit alike in some of the ending systems of me verbs. But by and large, I don't think you'll have too much difficulty identifying these forms. Questions, anybody, on that? And like I said, memorizing that little chart of contractions might be helpful on this, because it also serves to help you in some other things later on. Okay, chapter 24 is more of a syntax chapter. It's not dealing with any new forms, but it's dealing with the fact that other uses of the accusative. Is dealing with the fact that there are sentence constructions that use, in some cases, more than one accusative in a given sentence. The first example dealt with what we call an object complement. Example in English, the general called the captain a fool. Here we find the general being the subject, and he's calling the captain a fool. The captain would be the direct object, that's the one that's being called, and the phrase a fool would be what we call an object complement. It's kind of completing the idea of the verb, and so the full verbal action is to call someone a fool, and he applies this action to the captain, you see. So that's kind of the idea in English anyway. In Greek, what happens is a very similar structure, but of course in Greek there's different ways to designate an object, and so the object complement in Greek is also signified by something in the accusative case. And so you'll find two things in the accusative case in Greek as a result of this kind of construction. So that's the basic distinction there. Now, they may have In section 183, well, section 181 first illustrates what happens here in the Greek. Sentences similar to four, both the meaning and structure, also occur in Greek. Constituents of these Greek sentences may, as we might expect, occur in any order. Both the direct object and the object complement are in the accusative case, but the direct object is always more definite than the object complement. So to decide which is which, since they're both in the same case, you have to go by the same criteria for the discussion of what's more definite. And we talked earlier about the predicate nominatives. And he refers you back to section 58 and those five different criteria for determining which is more definite than the other. Same thing would apply here in determining which is the object complement and which is the direct object. Then there's also a section 183. He makes mention of the fact that the Greek sometimes employs hos, as, or ace, for to introduce the object complement. So those two words may sometimes be used to point out an object complement. One of them a preposition, the other one a particle. So, hos prophetein auton echon. You see, they regarded him as a prophet. Literally, it's they had him as a prophet. And the word as, hos, appears there. So that makes a real clear distinction here and shows you exactly which would have to be the object complement. Although your criteria, even if the hos wasn't there, the auton would have to be the direct object and the prophetein would have to be the object complement on the basis of the philosophy that the more definite one is the direct object. Since auton is a pronoun, it would have to be the more definite of the two. Okay, then says in section 184, slightly different sentence structure in which the object complement is replaced by an adjective also occurs both in English and Greek. And in Greek sentences of this type, the adjective is anarthrous and in the accusative case. So as far as its form is concerned, it's not much different. It's going to be in the accusative case also, even though it's an adjective. And you can see that adjectives and nouns sometimes overlap in their uses. This could almost be considered a substantive in a certain sense, although it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. Adjective like make you evident here, delon, would fit just fine as an adjective, even in English, in the translation. Okay, then he deals with passive constructions made out of this kind of thing. And in the bottom line is that when you take the object complement and its direct object and convert the whole structure into a passive, the object complement is going to be kind of a slave to the direct object, so it's also going to become in the nominative case in a passive construction. So here you'll have two nominatives in the sentence. And it's, I suppose, somewhat predictable. If you look at the top of page 145 there, he gives an example in Greek of two sentences here. Matthew 21:13, ho oikos mu oikos prosukhes kleithesetai, my house will be called a house of prayer. Okay, here is the passive sentence. And he says this may be regarded as a passive transform of kalesusun tono oikon mu oikon prosukhes. That would be a sentence that would have subject and then a direct object, house, and then an object complement, house of prayer, would be your object complement. If you convert that whole thing into a passive construction like it is in Matthew 21:13, then you find both oikos mu oikos prosukhes kleithesetai. There we find that both oikos and then oikos prosukhes, house of prayer, are in the nominative case. And of course you can still tell the difference between the object complement and the direct object in the normal form of the sentence because of the fact that the more definite one now is the what was the direct object but now is the subject. I suppose you call it subject. I don't know if you can call this a subject complement or what. They don't really term it that way, but that's the way it's functioning. Okay, then there is also a feature involving another use of the accusative whereby certain verbs will take more than one accusative. Go ahead, Glenn, before I get further.
Would that almost be called an appositive
then? Well, you've got to, I don't know if you would call it that, although it's very close. Yeah, it's very close to that kind of a usage because in a positive you juxtapose two things to kind of put them in the same position. And that's very much what's happening here. I suppose in an analysis, in diagramming or something, that may be what it would be called. Although the recognition of a passive verb form and so forth, you see this construction is a passive transform of an object complement construction. But now that it's in this form, it's very close to in a positive type of an idea. And I'm not sure what, I haven't heard grammarians really single this out and have label terminology for it, but it's very much like that. Okay. This last section deals with verbs, certain verbs that take more than one accusative, and it's because of the meaning of the verb. The didasco, for example, to teach, you can teach somebody something. And so there will be an accusative of the person that you teach, or the persons, and then there will be an accusative of the thing that you teach. And so this verb can take both accusatives. It doesn't have to take them both. It doesn't have to take them both, but it can. So he gives you an example of an accusative indicating the person taught, you are teaching us. An accusative of a thing being taught, you are teaching the way of God. And then with two accusatives, you are teaching the Jews apostasy, for example. It shows you both the person that is taught and the thing that is being taught. Aiteo, to ask someone for something, petitioning someone for something, you see, where you're asking for a thing or some request or something. Same thing. You can ask a person and make a request of something of a person. And so two accusatives will be used here. And again, same kind of construction here with accusative the person asked, they asked Pilate, with accusative the thing asked for, this man asked for the body of Jesus. And then with two accusatives, the son will ask the father for a fish. Of course, in the Greek, you don't need to put the word for. You just put it in the accusative case, and you have this verb taking two accusatives, and it all works out. Then the last example, erotao, to ask someone about something. That's more of a petition for information rather than for actually being given something. And there we see an example with each accusative. There's no example, I guess, of the accusative of the thing asked about by itself. But there are examples of both accusatives there. In the last example here, they asked him about the parables, or about, this has to be understood basically, but they asked him the parables in effect. It's clear there you have two accusatives, auton in the accusative and tas parabolas in the accusative. Okay, any questions on those double accusatives? Go ahead.
On the verbs used, you use aiteo instead of erotao in that last.
Yes, they'd be asking to give him the parables. Yeah, it would be more of So you usually do that if it's something they want these parables. And parables would now be a lot more concrete objects, I suppose. I mean, you usually think of it in terms of something material, something that's being given, rather than the conceptual sense, because.
It would be
figuratively looking at these parables as an entity, a treasure of some sort, you know, that they wanted, and it perhaps could be done to illustrate a real powerful figurative image. But since parables are information, you know, and teaching and that type of thing, things that are in that category generally are going to have erotao there rather than aiteo. But if you saw aiteo in an instance like that, where it was a conceptual thing, it would be far more graphic. You'd be doing a certain kind of a figurative painting of a picture there. And these things were being looked at. These parables now would be being looked at as something very tangible, very solid, very desirable, and so forth. So that's a good point. Okay. You probably wouldn't be likely to see the reverse, though, of where erotao was used, where aiteo should be used. I mean, that's kind of going. You can do figures of speech in one direction, but seldom in the other. Okay, the next couple of chapters deal with prepositions, and this is pretty much memorization of meanings and so forth. There is some discussion here to a basic degree about the fact that a given preposition in English may be rendered by a number of different ones in Greek and vice versa, and the linguistic systems are different. And the bottom line of that is basically that one needs to learn within the language the function of a given preposition and its root meaning and all the complications. So he doesn't go very far with that as far as his meaning is concerned, and we will be pursuing prepositions far more in depth in this year than we did last year. So Basically, though, he's broken them up into various categories according to how many, what cases they govern. A given preposition, you see, is going to precede the noun, and that noun is going to have to be in some case. And different prepositions are going to govern different cases. Some prepositions govern only one case, some prepositions govern two, and some govern three. And so, in other words, you might see a given preposition having an object in three different cases and slightly different shades of meaning with each one. Remember that case function is showing you something about the relationship between the noun and other words in the sentence. And it's almost a prepositional idea by itself. I mean, what we're doing here when we put prepositions with case functions is kind of putting two things that are very similar together. There are times when you can use simply a case, for example, a dative case, and in English we have to translate it by a preposition. Or in Greek they'll use a preposition plus the dative case and give even a more graphic picture. Sometimes the different cases have slight modifications to the root idea. Those are the kinds of things that we'll be pursuing a little bit more this year. Now, he lists a number of prepositions here, and this is mainly a matter of vocabulary. Prepositions with the accusative here, ana and ace. Prepositions with the dative, en and soon. Prepositions with the genitive, anti, apo, akri, ek, empros, then, enika, en opion, heos, opiso, pro, charin, choris. Number of prepositions here that are used with a genitive case. And he's got some remarks here about the meanings of these things, and a lot of that is just the philosophy of things being synonymous and so forth, which is highly questionable. But syntactically, here, section 195, dealing with prepositional phrases, is important, showing the construction of a prepositional phrase and how it modifies a sentence. Or a noun or something in the sentence. The construction consisting of a preposition and the noun it governs is called a prepositional phrase. The Greek prepositional phrases occur in syntactic situations similar to those in which English prepositional phrases are found, as may be seen from examples already cited in this lesson. And number one, Greek prepositional phrases, like those of English, may be syntactically associated with verbs, so they might be called adverbial. That is, they're modifying the idea of the verb. And so, e baptiste eston Jordanein, he was baptized in the Jordan. The phrase in the Jordan tells you something about where the baptism took place. It's adverbial, it's modifying the idea of the verb, it's giving some qualification to the verbal idea. Other prepositional phrases modify nouns. This would be what we call an adjectival type of prepositional phrase. And so here, anthropos en pneumati akatharto, a man with an unclean spirit. So the phrase with an unclean spirit is modifying man here. It's adjectival. It's telling you what kind of a man it is. So these functions are pretty much the same as we've seen for other words in the language, adverbs and adjectives and so forth. Now, when a Greek prepositional phrase modifies an articular noun, it may simply follow the noun, as in ta ethne en sarki, the Gentile from the flesh. However, Greek prepositional phrases, unlike English prepositional phrases, may have the ordinary attributive positions proper to adjectives. So you can stick a prepositional phrase right into an attributive position. Very commonly, they'll just follow the noun and be in somewhat what we call a predicate position, I suppose, just following the noun with no repetition of the article. But very often also, they'll be in an attributive position, and they'll come between the article and the noun, or they'll have an article repeated and then have the prepositional phrase follow. And it's hard to say what the difference is. About the only thing I can say as far as the feeling is concerned is that there seems to be more emphasis when you put it in one of these attributive positions. It seems to be more zeroing in on that phrase. For example, to phos to en soi, the light which is in you. You could say to phos en soi, the light in you, which is in you, and still get the same translation. But to say to phos to en soi kind of gives a little bit more, it sets off that adjective a little bit more, and causes a little bit more attention to be drawn to it. The light which is in you, you see, the light, the in you light, you know, it's a little bit more specific. It's a feeling that you get when you read it that transmits something to you. It transmits a bit more emphasis, a bit more specific concentration on the fact, rather than the more common way just to put the prepositional phrase following it. So that's something you'll get the feeling for as you read more and more. Then something very interesting. Yes, go ahead.
Basically, you see prepositional phrases in the second predicate position, right? right?
Right. Second predicate position or one of the two attributive positions.
Is that on the first
one? Well, there wouldn't be any real problem that I can see. Yeah, I think the biggest confusion would be that if you put it out in front, the inclination might be to take it as modifying something. You know, since prepositional phrases can be both adverbial and adjectival, there might be a confusion or a tendency to take it as modifying the verb idea or something like that. And usually your context would resolve that, but I think more often than not, I can't think of an example of it. What's that? Yeah, unless it's right out in the front or in some position where there isn't going to be any confusion about it. That's maybe where you would likely see that. You wouldn't see that kind of a position if it was going to generate an ambiguity as to what the prepositional phrase is modifying. So I think by and large you're going to see it following the noun that it modifies. Okay, well, we'll stop here and we'll say a little bit more about prepositions tomorrow. And then we'll be, let's see, our next chapter is me, verbs, present, and it'll be into participles. And that's our next major category. Participles and then a little bit on infinitives, and then pretty much we're up to where we are now. Okay.
This is my mini thesis back.
Okay.
Did they print?
The mini thesis are printed, so if you didn't get your copy yet, we've been trying to get them to everybody, but there's one in the grad library, you can come pick it up right now, the mini thesis. And the compilation, we decided it was 800 pages long or something, so we're not going to print it up, we're just going to put the original in the library and let anybody copy it if they want to.
Will those the compilation notes be returned?
Yes, they should be soon. I'll have to get with Tony on that. He's got, you know...